The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, it is that time of the week. This is actually the best Monday we've had all week. And it is time for the True Wealth Radio Show. And for the moment, you've got a fantastic monologue. Although I have it on good authority that Santa will be delivering my co-host shortly. So here we are, end of the year already. And tomorrow's Christmas Eve. And if you're wondering, well, why aren't you doing the show on your regular Tuesday? It's because, did I mention tomorrow's Christmas Eve? Intend to be spending that time with family, of course, and celebrating. In our house, I'd also straight up say it like, Merry Christmas, everybody. And if that's not what you celebrate, turns out that's okay too. But that's what we celebrate, and I'm stoked for it. So really excited for that one. A little bit different this year because we've got one of our daughters is abroad, and some of you know about that, but she is an exchange student this year, so just shakes things up a little bit. But you know what, the holiday spirit is here nevertheless. So thinking about the show topics of the day, here we are, we reached the end of the year, and you know that is a fun one, but we've done this before. I have this, the, you know, sort of the holiday tradition. There's the 12 days of Christmas, if you know the fun Christmas carol. And I thought it'd be fun to do the 12 days of, or like the 12 tips before Christmas so that you can rock a great 2025. So this year, we're going to kind of lean into the theme a little bit. And, you know, we've got, you know, starting with the 12th day. So basically, I'm going to give you 12 things to think about. And a lot of these you've probably heard before, but you know, sometimes I have to do this because it's like, well, we're going to, what do you say politely? Like, do we just going to beat it into your head or are we going to, no, it's not that. It's that some of these things are worth repeating, right? And some of them are basic low hanging fruit and then there's others less so, but I think this is really important because so often we just overlook some stuff here. I just finished meeting with some friends, talking to their kids about a lot of this stuff too. The idea of, you know, this show's True Wealth, we talk about all kinds of stuff, but one of the things we talk about a lot is investing, okay? And why is investing such a big deal, right? And it's the idea that you can make a much better tomorrow if you start with a good foundation today, right? And this is kind of a tricky one because a lot of folks, it's so much easier to just get caught up in, well, I deal with the thing in front of me, right? So the challenge of investing, being longer term and thinking longer term, what does really longer term mean? You don't have to think 30 years from now immediately. The results may come in 30 years, but you don't start with that. You just start with, what if I just started a plan now and that plan generated a good result 30 years out, right? And by the way, I can officially say, Santa has delivered as promised.
Yeah, so, I snuck
welcome,
in the back, Jack.
Matthew. You go, yeah. Matthew's like, it's not trouble, but something's up when he goes from Matt to Matthew. Welcome,
yeah,
Matthew.
It was really weird listening to the show as I'm driving here.
He's like, wait a second. Well, and so I don't know if you heard kind of the lead up.
Yeah, but like 12 different items.
Well,
leading
so
up.
The 12 days of Christmas, right?
Yeah.
So I thought 12 tips for Christmas. And so I've got them right in front of me. So that's where we start with. I'm just going to jump right in on the number 12. We'll go from 12 down to number
okay.
one, right? So number 12 is you start with clear goals. Okay.
Mm.
That sounds so overly simplistic.
Here's one for you. Get in better shape so your back doesn't go
okay.
out.
Poor Matt.
I know.
I'm at the called him earlier and I'm like, the old guy's having fewer back problems than you. Talk
mm-hmm.
to me.
Yeah. Need more resistance training in my life.
More resistance training. You know what? That's one of those. I don't know how we do the last show of the year or the first show of next year, but I'm super big on this. This fits in goals, by the way. Write them down, okay? A goal that you keep in between your ears, that's just a dream without a deadline.
It's really hard when they're not measurable, too.
You gotta. Did you see my notes?
Yeah. Can I write in there, get in better shape? Well, what does that really mean?
So clear goals starting with the SMART method, right? Which is specific, measurable, actionable. And then it's time-bound, and R means something else in there. I got to remember what the R in the SMART means. But realistic, I think, is what it is.
Yeah.
Realistic and time-bound. So if you think about all of your goals in that respect, it's like then the idea is that you can't have a goal that's vague, right? Things like, I'm going to lose weight. It's better than, like, I'm going to be nice. Mm-hmm. Right? That's super subjective, super mushy, right? It's like, I'm just going to try to be an optimist. Like, okay, I don't know what kind of goal that is, because how do you measure whether or not it worked? Okay? But if you say, I want to lose 12 pounds.
The optimism meter.
Yes, of course. I failed to check Amazon for the optimism meter. You know, every now and then, so Matt and I are terrible for this, the t-shirts that we think we should have, right?
Yeah.
And I want, like, can you imagine making, like, fake products for things that you can't measure, like an optimism meter?
Yeah.
And just, like, what's this on Amazon? It's like, why isn't it working? It's like, no, you're just not optimistic enough. Try harder.
Yeah. Or it just randomly starts moving. And it's like, oh, what did I do this time?
It's like a mood ring, but worse.
Con ourselves to millions. Optimism meters.
The optimism
meter. I have one that I'll sell you. It's $129 in free shipping.
I see it.
Call in and give me your credit card number.
What a bargain. Oh, my goodness. So, okay. Start with goals. And, Matt, give me a handful of – I mean, you were like, hey, exercise more, right?
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily a financial goal. Let's like set a financial goal. Like, let's say somebody's never started.
Okay.
And let's say this is a person that's you're under 40 and you've never been investing. What's a first goal that you would look toward?
I would analyze, am I in debt? If I'm in debt, I'm getting out of debt.
Okay.
If I'm not in debt and I don't have emergency savings, I'm getting my emergency savings taken care of.
Yeah.
After I've got the emergency savings taken care of and I'm funding my retirement accounts, which is a big one. Some people don't do it. They don't pay their future selves anything, right? Like,
yeah. I feel like he's naming the Dave Ramsey baby steps, by the way.
Yeah, let's get more exotic, though. I think establishing like something that you want to buy that's an asset. A lot of people don't look at that as like a goal, right? Like, what is it that you're trying to do that's going to make your life better in some way? And then working towards that.
I like the way you phrased it as asset, mm-hmm. right? Because I challenged folks, an asset, something that appreciates in value. Then you have liabilities,
mm-hmm.
right? Things that don't appreciate in value, or you buy something and you still owe money on it and it's losing value.
Right.
Then you've got the weird one, which is a depreciating asset.
That's the trap that most people get thrown into, right? It's like, well, I need this $80,000 Tahoe. It's like, well...
Here's also the trap of depreciating asset is I'm going to break from script here too. Like, this is the math of depreciating asset calculation, right? I'm going to give like the best I can to give you a tip. We have to be careful about advice, but this is like a frame up so if you have an asset that loses value. So I'm thinking about cars as a really common example, but computers, other things like that, you're going to buy something and it's going to lose value. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Your phone. Okay.
Yep.
Great example. Your smartphone loses value with time.
Yep.
Right? Batteries wear out, things break, it becomes an obsolete model. But it enables you to do things that are profitable, right? And so the math is, do you make more than you spent on it? Okay. And then you have to examine not just break even or like a little bit, but is it sufficient margin to be worth it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the grayest area in there, but sufficient margin is that return on value of time and resource, right?
Yeah.
This is where you run into the issue where somebody pays too much for a car.
Yeah, and right? What? And you got to ask yourself use case. I did this, right? I'm like, okay, I have a kid on the way. I have a dog. We're always taking the dog wherever we go. And with a kid, you kind of need a semi-reliable vehicle. And I'm like, well, you kind of need space, right? So SUV. But what SUV? And so you start looking at it, and it's like, well, the Tahoe is $80,000, and this Volkswagen is $40,000. They're going to do the same thing. They have basically the same amount of space.
Yeah.
Like, I would love the Tahoe because it's cool, but the Volkswagen's way more practical. So went with the Volkswagen.
Yep. Because, again, and that's a super good example, right?
Yeah.
Because the utility
is the same.
Was really similar for you.
Yeah.
Because you're not towing or doing something there, it would be a significant difference. You had, you know. So given the same or nearly identical utility, then price becomes a big issue. And then it's like, well, what exactly are you paying for?
Mm-hmm.
Was it significantly improved resale? Not really.
No, because they're both going to depreciate.
Was it different operating costs? I mean, Volkswagens might cost a little more if something breaks.
Yeah.
But half the price in acquisition.
Right.
Right? Both would have warranties if they're new.
Yep.
Right? And so you look at that and you say, and in the scale of what you're doing, now, Matt, if you're earning $2 million a year.
Then does it matter?
Buy what you want.
Yeah.
Right? You can afford it.
Yep.
Right? But if you're earning less than that, then you're examining how much of your income do you want committed to that in your budget?
Right, exactly.
Which, interestingly enough, would be day number 11 is setting a realistic budget.
Yes, that right? is a big piece.
Right? So, you know, if you have tip number, so first, we want to set goals. Second, set a budget. But that budget, you see how they're connected there too?
Oh, yeah. It really is.
And so these to me are, you know, just key foundational things in every financial strategy. I think that even when you make a bunch of money, you should still have a budget,
yep.
right? Because what happens when you don't is things creep, right? Things just creep. It's amazing how lifestyle creeps because it can. It's like, well, we just go out to dinner because the money's there.
Yep.
And it's amazing how money can find its way out of your possession if you don't give it a job and some accountability,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just remarkable. So anyway, as I look at the clock, I mean, gosh, Mondays are already cruising. So we got days 12 and 11 in there with the budget. I will sneak this in there. Typical budget, how much should people be budgeting for investing?
Is this a lead into a break, or do you want me to go ahead and give you what I think?
You know what? Let's do this. Give me what you think, and then we'll confirm it after the break.
I think you should be saving somewhere around 10 to 15%.
Okay, we're going to come back. Is he right?
Ooh.
Stick around and we'll find out, because we've got some data and this is an opportunity to pull one out of the archives. One of my favorites, the days of the week budgeting method.
Okay.
All right. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Monday you've had all week.
Never going
to
get
I know, that is just not sounding
one.
Right yeah. at all. We're Tuesday, folk,
yeah.
I tell you what. But hey, we got tomorrow being Christmas Eve. I'm okay doing this.
Right? Yep.
I'm okay with that. We'll spend tomorrow with family. Reminder, you can grab us on a podcast and get caught up. When we left our heroes last, we were asking, what should we do about the budget? Before I answer this, Matt, I had this theory years ago, and it kind of breaks down. It's got a little bit of a like biblical undertone to this.
Sure.
Like, this is how I created this, right? So it goes like this, right? When God created in the origin story, it's 7 days, right? So 6 days of work, seventh day of rest. But there's this recurring theme of blocks of seven that occur biblically. And so I started looking at budgets. And, you know, days of the week come in seven, too. And it became really easy. And I thought, you know, entrepreneurs oftentimes have sort of a budget challenge because it's like, well, where do you spend? And when you when you don't have taxes automatically taken out of a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's where this came from. For a lot of you guys that are working for somebody and you have a paycheck, then the taxes don't necessarily work the same way. So this is less applicable. But stick around because it's kind of novel. 7 goes into 100, close to 15.
Okay.
Right? So 7 times 15, just a little over 100. It's like 14 point something to get to the percentages here. So you were correct in your answer, 10 to 15%.
Hmm.
Most folks say about 15% savings rate is where you want to target investment-wise. But check this out. If you have 7 days of the week, I've often said, so that you work the first 2 days, pay your taxes. The next 3 days are what you live on. So you've got Monday, Tuesday taxes, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You're going to pay for life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Saturday is to save. Sunday is to give.
Mm.
Okay? If you break that down, and what happens? Well, what if I make a whole bunch of money? Well, if you make a whole bunch of money, you might be doing Monday, Tuesday, and maybe Wednesday in taxes,
mm-hmm.
right? But you make so much money that you can afford to live on just Thursday and Friday anyway. And then you still have your saving, which is about 15%, and your giving. And biblically speaking, tithe, there's some debate around that at 10%. So maybe you're giving more than you need to. But I like to err on the side of generosity, right? Or if you were going to get really specific on percentages, you know, you end up doing about a third go to taxes and a third go to your lifestyle, and then the rest of it goes into savings and giving, right? So mm-hmm. a third. But nevertheless, it still kind of works out days of the week pretty well, and that aligns right there with that 15% that you were talking about.
Yeah.
So if you're ever looking for kind of a mental hack for that, you just go, well, think about the days of the week.
I like that.
You know, Monday, Tuesday, we partner with the government. The rest of the work week is ours, Saturday to save, Sunday to give, right? And if you start on Sunday, then you do the giving first, right? It all depends on where you start the calendar. And that's a whole different subject about like, well, what if I run out of money? Then I don't have any to give. And I'm like, all the studies are really clear about this. You should include some giving in the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It changes the way you interact with money, and it tends to lead people to greater financial success, not less. I can't explain why. I can just tell you that anecdotally, that's what I've always seen and experienced. And so it's hard to discount that, right?
Right.
I think the folks that try to hang on to too much stop participating the same way in the economy. And you can call it karma, you can call it a lot of things, but it doesn't work out when you start to chokehold everything.
You
have to let it move a little bit. Got to give it enough freedom to settle. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that doesn't mean don't budget. It means just be aware, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's next on this list?
Well, crazy enough, you kind of nailed it already as you started about number 10. You want to start maxing out tax-advantaged accounts, starting with, I believe, your employer retirement account. Okay, and the reason for that, some people say you should max out a Roth first. So that depends on your income levels and future tax rates, right? But employer retirement plans typically include employer match.
Right.
Go get the free money.
Yeah. Rarely do we get to say the words free money.
Yeah. Well, free to you.
Yeah.
Right? Go get, and maybe it's like, no, I worked for that. I don't care how you want to, you know, slice and dice it. Go get it.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you don't get it, you don't get it.
Derp. People pass it up all the time.
Oh, man. Right? It's just bizarro land. I mean, I've tried to tell people, if you math it out, right, you're better off getting the money, getting vested, and then taking it out early and paying the penalties. You still come out ahead.
Right.
So, like, do it. Like, there's just no math where that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but surprisingly enough, the good news is we don't have to hang out on that much because it's so easy. Day 9. All right.
On the 9th day of Christmas.
I know.
Diversification.
So the question is always how much?
You know one that recently has come up?
Hmm.
I had a conversation with someone and they said, I've got this, cryptocurrency and that cryptocurrency and this one and that one and that one. And they're like, see, I'm diversified. And I'm like, but it's all cryptocurrency.
It's like saying, I own Home Depot and Lowe's. I'm diversified.
Uh-huh.
Right? It's like you own hardware stores and that's it. If the economy slows down and people stop putting money into their homes, then what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you suffer because everything's going to be affected by the system that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that. So you have just properly illustrated the concept of correlation.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Diversification only works when you have low correlation.
Yeah. So if you own Exxon and Chevron and Concord, like if you own everyone that just sells gasoline, you're not really, that's all highly correlated.
It's golf clubs and snow skis.
Yeah.
Right? You can own golf clubs and baseball bats, and they're less diversified, but they're still kind of fair weather sports.
Mm-hmm.
Golf clubs and snow skis, different seasonality.
Exactly.
Right? And so you're getting more benefit to your diversification, right? You say, you know, snow skis and apples, right? That's like, well, now we're getting like food, the consumer staples and snow skis. They're totally different, right? Some of the stuff is like, well, you got to eat, right? Other stuff, it's like, well, you know, that's recreation.
I think too infrequently people look at this and they always just talk about, well, stocks and bonds. I've got this amount here and this amount here. But what a lot of people don't realize is sometimes, you know, you might just own a lot of stocks that all kind of do the same thing. And like you just said, it's so highly correlated that even though you have stocks and bonds, maybe you really only kind of have two asset classes.
Yeah. And sometimes the strategies are really similar too. This is why one of the things that we try to do is look at historical correlation, meaning if you look back in time, have the stocks or have the assets that you own, let's just call them assets, do they behave similarly in similar environments?
What you're trying to say in an easy way is like the bonds could go down and the stocks could go down depending on which ones you own.
Yep.
And so if you've got those asset classes highly correlated, well then...
Yeah, what I'm saying is if you have high correlation, then your diversification doesn't work as well.
Right.
Okay, it's a fancy terms when you start throwing these away because there's so many shuns, right? I would joke, mind your shuns, diversification, allocation, and correlation, okay? It's the ratios and how closely they are related to each other because diversification only works if they are not related to each other, okay? Right? It's like, oh, okay, well, I have a – all right, enough. I'm beating on this horse, right? You guys get it. So how many positions do you need to be diversified?
There is no magic number.
There's really not a magic number, but there is a statistical number where you start to get diminishing return.
I'm going to guess it's around 30.
Yeah, somewhere between 25 and 30. What you see is, and this is measuring using a metric called standard deviation. Okay, it's a statistical measurement. Standard deviation is a measure of how much a portfolio would fluctuate up or down in value. And when you add additional positions, what you see is the standard deviation tends to narrow, right?
Yeah.
But the difference between having, say, 25 positions and having 30 positions, the standard deviation doesn't change very much. The difference between having 10 positions and 20 positions, it changes a lot, right?
Exactly.
So you really see a reduction in standard deviation when you go from 10 positions to 20.
Yeah.
When you go from 30 positions to 1,000 positions, you see very little change. What we see is a statistically diminishing marginal return. Fancy way to say it works less. The more positions you add, the less beneficial it is. Doesn't mean it's not beneficial. It means it's not adding incrementally more benefit with enough statistical significance to matter, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you own 1,000 of the companies and one of them jumps 100%,
yeah. So it's like, we joke and call it diversification, right? When you water it down, here's the thing. If you go and buy 200 stocks, why not just buy an index fund?
Mm-hmm.
There's another way you can measure that, by the way, something that we call R squared.
Yeah.
Now, R squared is a statistical measurement to say how much of that index's performance can be, or how much of my portfolio's performance can be explained by its corresponding benchmark. Right. And so it's like, oh, I have an R squared of 0.99. It's like, good. You got 99% of the returns are the same as your index.
Yeah. And
an index.
You just fluffed it up as something to masquerade as like you own all these positions. But congratulations. You could have probably bought the index and it would have been roughly the same price.
It's like getting in a boat, thrashing really hard. But the only movement you have is the current taking downstream anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like your effort was meaningless. You didn't need to do all the effort. You could have just stayed in the boat, gone downstream because that's what the index was going to give you anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a kind of a more serious one. But that's the idea behind getting to, like, healthy diversification. And so You know, I think that there's not a specific number. It's more about, can you get to the point that your standard deviation is flattening out? But it tends to be somewhere in that 25-ish positions if they're all low correlation. Tends to. Don't quote me on it.
Okay.
All right. All right. So day eight. This one is super easy, right?
Let's make it hard.
It's easy enough that we don't need to spend a ton of time on it, but automate your investing.
Mm. Do you want to elaborate kind of on where you're going with that?
If you're already in a 401k plan or something, every time you get a paycheck, a little bit goes into the stock market for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not doing that, consider setting up a payroll automatic deposit, or not payroll, but like just automatic deposit from your bank account. You get a benefit when it automatically happens.
Yeah.
It's predictable, right? Yep. So it tends to happen. You get follow through. And you also get cost averaging, right? If the markets are down and you're buying the same amount every on a regular basis, then good. You get to buy when the market's cheap.
Yeah. It right? works. I mean, just let that thing trickle and accumulate. And
yes.
Before you know it, there's something there.
And it kind of gets us out of the idea of timing the markets too. And just so just be consistent, right? Don't overthink this thing. How do you make diamonds? Time and pressure.
Yep.
Right? How do you grow investment portfolios? Time, pressure, right? The pressure is just like keep on it. Just yep. keep making contributions. It doesn't have to be huge, but it needs to be consistent.
Yeah.
So anyway, that gets us what? Through day eight?
Eight.
All right. Through day eight. And look at that. We got to take our next break. So okay. Day eight, good time for a break. When we come back, we have still got seven more days to go. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
No. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right. We're coming up on Christmas, so we themed it out because, I don't know, we're sellouts for the holidays. We are going through the 12 tips for Christmas for investors, right? And so I feel like a lot of our investors, if you're more advanced than this, it's like I'd tell you to tune out, but don't do that. You just need to listen to this and then refer it to the people that need basic help.
We're on tip number 7, right?
I believe so.
Is that the one where we recommend going into massive amounts of credit card debt to fund all of the presents and making sure that, you know, it's wall to ceiling with
that, that is, in fact, what the recommendation is. Yeah. It's just spend into oblivion with no accountability whatsoever.
Yeah, like that new car you want to just get it and put the ribbon on it.
On a credit card, yeah. Actually.
The down payment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, stolen credit card, probably even better.
There you go.
I got to get really extreme here, so some idiot's going to be listening to this and go like, well, I heard him say on the radio, I'm like, gosh, you and your discernment. That's where it started, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, here's a New Year's resolution for this person. Make better decisions. All right. Glad we had this talk. For the rest of our listeners, they know we're joking. That's the cool part. Like, I'm so glad we have smart listeners. Thank
it's
you,
nice.
Listeners, for not being idiots. Right? We all know who the idiots are. We're not saying anything. But thank you, listeners, for not being them.
You deserve this.
Treat yourself. Golly. All right. It's I feel like this one should be really obvious.
Okay.
But and in some ways, a lot of these are, and yet people miss this. Okay. So one, look for low fees. Okay. Now, I'll be the first to say it drives me nuts when I think the joke is like your investment portfolio is not a small dog, right? You don't go running around looking for fee all the time. Okay. But fees are relevant because one of the things that they have shown, past studies have shown that the mutual funds that have very high fees tend to perform poorly. So you want to be aware of that, that it affects performance. High fees are like drag on a portfolio. Now, I will be the first to tell you that if you could find somewhere where high fees didn't matter because the performance was yeah. so high anyway.
You're paying 5% a year but getting 40%
yeah,
returns.
I mean, who cares what it costs if you're getting the outcomes that you're looking for?
Yeah.
Right? Who cares? The question is, are they real, right? I mean, I can't remember who, but there's a hedge fund that was one of the original super quant hedge funds, and they were far and away ahead of everybody else. It was like Renaissance or something like that. I don't think you can even get into it, but it was run by a bunch of math wonks. And they were doing big data before big data was a thing. And they had a run where they turned, you know, millions into billions. And it was staggering how much better their performance was than anywhere else. And I think they were charging 2 and 20, which was the industry standard of a 2% fee plus 20% of whatever they outperformed their benchmark over. And they were tonning it. Like,
wow.
They were making tons of money, and their investors made tons of money. It's like the best performing hedge fund of all time, but it's also one where good luck duplicating that. Like, everybody's fighting AI now. So the competitive advantages that existed are all starting to wash back out of the market.
Yeah.
Remember, markets abhor exploits. They just abhor them, right?
Right.
So anyway, but the fees do, they matter, right? Because all other things created equal, the lower fee means you keep more of it. Okay. There's another thing that, please, I'm going to go ahead and say this. This is like a subtle plug for advisors everywhere, not just us, even though we're total suck-ups and we would say, like, you know, give us a shot. But here's the deal. There is a pricing difference between DIY and done for you.
Yeah, there has to be.
There has to, but people that will go to advisors and say, well, I want you to buy index funds for me, and I don't want to pay you. And it's like, well, then you want to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's really what, I want you to do it for me. So no, you want to be able to blame the advisor if you choose poorly, but you don't want to pay the advisor to help, right? So like, that's not a good solution for the advisor. Why would they want you as a client? It's like, so well, let me understand this. I get all the liability, but none of the good stuff.
Right.
Like, tell me again how that's a good idea for any professional. It's like, well, give the services away, but get liability while doing it.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's the short answer to that. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And again, thankfully, our listeners are relatively smart, right? And they already figured this out. They go, Doug, you know how to say this, Dave? It's like, we get it, right? We hire our advisor because they're doing it for us. And there is a cost to having it done for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it should be a fair and reasonable cost.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you can't get too far out of line.
Well,
because
you know,
then no one's going to hire you.
If it cannibalizes the investment outcomes too much,
yeah,
then that's not good. But I'll tell you what, here's probably one of the number one rumors out there too. I don't think that performance is where the advisor adds the value, right? I don't think it's because there's this mystery where if you go to a financial advisor, you're going to make better returns. And I think the market kind of gives you what it gives you.
Yeah.
I think where advisors can add value is in strategies, better tax management, efficiencies where they may actually more than pay for themselves in improved outcomes
mm-hmm.
by helping you have better behaviors and better decisions and by avoiding costly mistakes.
Right.
So that's where I think the advantage is. And so I don't think it's always a cost the way it's typically counted, but it's not free either.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then again, like very few things in life are free as we understand them. So there we go. Okay.
It's expensive to learn the tax code.
It is. this one's actually really, I don't know if I buy this one.
What is it? And I'll tell you if I buy it. How about that?
Rebalance quarterly.
Ooh. So not necessarily.
Yeah,
here's an example of where that might be able to bite you, right? So if you got into an investment and you're happy with the investment, you think long-term this investment should be good, but you're trading just to trade, you might be unnecessarily triggering tax consequences to you. Remember I just said it's expensive to learn the hard way with taxes?
Oh, buddy.
So you might be blowing yourself on taxes where you could maybe, if you are convicted that this is a good investment, hold that for a year or more and then transition from a short-term capital gain, which could be your income tax rate, to a long-term capital gain, which might be more like 10 or 12%.
Right.
It's a big difference. When you start, you know, if it's 20%, that's a huge, huge difference in trying to capture some sort of gain.
It really is. I am also of the belief that you're better off having strategic reasons and tactical reasons. This is some kind of, they're not the same thing, right? But there should be a reason for the rebalance rather than just, I showed up at this moment and did it, right?
Yeah.
It's like you want some parameters to allow an investment to run if it's growing.
Right.
But at a certain point, you want to capture gains the same way when something is way off. If you have gains somewhere else and you'd like to rebalance to buy something, a part of it that's on sale, those are good. But I prefer trigger points because it gives you the opportunity to be more tax efficient.
Right. I mean, I can think of a position that we held and it jumped like, what, 20-something percent in the matter of 2 days.
Yeah.
And then we looked at that and we're like, wait, that's a huge probably overreaction to a news cycle. And we're like, well, we've only owned it 2 days, but we should probably just come back at a later time.
Yeah.
And so we sold it. Now, if we had waited for an entire quarter, it would have already like readjusted and we would have missed the gain. So quarterlies, that to me is, like you said, it's irrelevant. Yeah. A trigger point is a lot better. Yeah.
Circumstantial rebalancing. But you probably shouldn't wait more than a quarter to look at it. But
right.
I think having rule-based rebalancing makes more sense.
And
of course, we have our own rules. We're not going to go into that on the show, but that's how we address it for our customers.
So, right.
Anyway. All right, and then I look at the clock and go, one last break, man.
How many do we have left?
So we have gotten through day six.
Oh, my gosh.
We have five to go. I'll bet you we can make it.
You think?
Yeah, we can.
Let's try it.
All right, so stick around. We'll be right back where we're going to cover the last 5 days in the last segment. I'm not going to say they're the best days, but they might be the best days.
Okay.
Very good days. Very good days. Stick around, everybody. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. On News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Exactly. So I got to come up with the
Be
idea.
Be prepared.
Now.
Just ChatGPT it, David.
No.
I introduced that to my dad today.
Uh-oh.
I'm like, you got to download the app. It's going to change your life.
It does. No.
Google will go away.
Google's probably trying to, like, you know, ride the coat. They're trying to do their own now.
Yeah, we'll see how that works out.
I know, right?
Hey, don't we have six more of these things to go
through?
We do.
Welcome
back.
Let's
do it.
Still True Welsh radio show, right, on this Monday. So there we go. We've got the 12 days of Christmas. Quick recap if you've missed them, right? What on the 12th day of Christmas your investment advisor said to you, set clear financial goals that are smart, measurable, which you should know what that means, right? Specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. On the 11th day of Christmas, build a budget and include 15% or so for investing. On the 10th day of Christmas, max out all of your tax advantage accounts, specifically employer-sponsored accounts. On the 9th day, diversify your portfolio appropriately, mindfully for correlation and allocation across asset classes. Two, lower your overall standard deviation. There you go. On the 8th day of Christmas, we said, don't forget to automate your investments. On the 7th day, minimize fees. And on the 6th day, rebalance. And we recommend on a trigger point basis.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's opportunistic.
So now we're on the 5th day?
On the 5th day of Christmas, Dave Ramsey said to me, build an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months of expenses. And why 3 to 6 months, Matt?
Well, you lose your job. Your roof leaks, something major comes up in your life, you need to be able to not have to just max a credit card out.
Yeah. And why 3 months versus 6 months?
You know, I've never actually fully understood why they say somewhere between 3 and 6 months.
I can share. There's actually
a real reason behind this?
Yeah, there's a math reason. Just so it really.
I thought it was just like 3 months if you're kind of less ambitious and you don't.
Nope. Here's the way this is, in theory, was designed, right? So 3 months is on the shorter end of things, but if you have two people working, then the probability that both people are out at the same time is pretty low.
Oh, right? That makes sense.
Now, two people working in the same employer, risk goes up, right? So you start considering more. Why 3 months? Typically, that was the exclusionary period before disability income insurance kicks on. So you got to pay for the first 3 months before the disability would kick on. So you've got two people, two disabilities, it would be 6 months.
Is that number gross or net?
That number is beans and rice. That's what I would say. It's like the minimum viable to so that you could survive.
Well,
you
know, is the 3 to 6 months like talking about your joint gross income, your net income?
No, that's what I mean. It's 3 to 6 months of survival income, right? Like you can shut out all
not
of the fun
full
stuff.
Income.
I think that that's a
that's kind of
that's
yeah.
how many angels can dance on the head of a pin kind
right?
of question.
I've always wondered that. Like, what do they really mean?
Well,
here?
The idea would be. You need to be able to survive, pay your bills, and sort of meet life support. So I like to say it's life support for 3 to 6 months, gotcha. Depending on the number of lives, right? it's not like go to Disneyland reserves. It
yeah.
is life support reserves.
Okay.
And if you can afford more than that, great. But usually what happens
is— Can you ever think of a moment where like you would like tell someone, go ahead and drain that fund? Like— I mean, obviously, it's an emergency fund. It may be for an emergency, but can you ever think of a time outside of an emergency where you might say, yeah, go ahead and drain the emergency savings?
So, I mean, if it was an actual expense that you needed to do and you were going to fill it back up, I would say there are times when it might be cheaper than if you were going to otherwise try to put something on a credit card.
Sure.
So I see the scenario where somebody in retirement has pensioned
like,
up a whole lot, but they don't have a big nest egg and they need a new roof. And it's like, well, it's actually cheaper to use your emergency fund and then fill it back up than it is to put the roof on a credit
what
card.
What if they said, hey, I have an opportunity to buy an asset and I have a really good feeling that I'm getting it maybe below what it's worth?
I think it's just a matter of like, that's a risk assessment.
Yeah.
It's not really a right, wrong, yes, yeah. no thing. It's a... You'd really have to understand the risks.
The unique circumstances.
Yeah, because the emergency fund, it's not that it's untouchable. It's that it's you touch it in the reasons that you need it. It's not the other reason it exists is so that you don't have to raid your investments and blow them up at an inopportune time.
Right.
Right? So like in retirement, you know, you could address some of that through bucketing methods, right? Like, okay, well, you need less emergency fund in retirement because you got this nest egg now. That kind of is the emergency fund.
And I think it also depends on like background family dynamics of like, well, do you have someone there that's going to bail you out if something really does hit the fan too? Because
it depends
like,
on the bailout, right?
Right.
Like, does the family buy your roof? That's different than can the family help, you know, babysit or something.
Right.
So,
yeah. It's really variable.
Okay. So after building day four,
okay.
So we look on the final moments of the show. Avoid market timing, right?
Mm-hmm.
This one is fun because you've probably heard things like if you miss the 10 best days of the market in a year, you
that's what I was just going to quote. Yep.
That is statistically true. It's also seldom paired with what happens if you missed the 10 worst days in the market.
Which
if you missed the 10 worst days and kept the 10 best days, your return goes way up.
So be a prophet or
here's an even crazier statistic. I did the math on it once, and so I haven't updated it recently, but you know, about 10 years ago when I did this, had you missed the 10 best and worst days, your average return for the year goes up.
Mm.
So the lesson here is that actually big up days and big down days tend to come during periods of heightened volatility.
And if
so
you can just skip the volatility.
Miss high volatility and you turn out better. The problem is timing the market is really difficult. So statistically, we can't really do it with any consistency. So just said don't do it.
Yep.
Right. Day three, research before buying. What a shock, right? If you think like, do you need to know what you're buying before you buy it?
What a revelation.
I know. I don't know that I can go any further on
no.
that one. Monitor progress quarterly, but more importantly, avoid emotional decisions. That one may be number one in all of investing.
Yeah.
Right? Avoid emotional decisions.
We see it all the time.
Right? ER docs are not allowed to operate on their own family. You know why? Emotionally compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this is something that it's why trading is so much harder than investing. Emotionally compromised decisions tend to go poorly.
Yep.
So that is it. And then the last one on our list was focus on the long term. But I think that all comes together the same concept. I mean, if we were to summarize it easily, it's create a budget and then commit to it, right? And then you want to save intentionally with the long term in mind, keep fees appropriate, mind your shuns of diversification, allocation, and correlation. Automate your investment frequency. Then you want to maximize the free money you can get through employers. mind taxes along the way, and avoid the emotional decisions that come along with it.
That's perfect.
What did I miss in there?
I think you missed the part where you tell them how to get a hold of us.
I forgot, Matt. How do they get a hold of us?
Okay, littlejohnfs.com. You can chat us there. You can even text us at the phone number. The phone number is 541-375-0898.
Yep. And, you know, it's a fun thing we talk about that these are the tips for investing, right? There's actually a whole broader landscape to this around planning. And that's like, okay, so we set a budget. What's the budget for, right? Oh, we're setting goals. What are they and how do we do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I could for a moment go again, it's not really on the 12 days theme, but the idea behind planning is that you have these intentional outcomes, right? I want these things to happen someday. Okay, how do you reverse engineer them so that that can become a real thing and not just a wish?
The reaction I get the most after meeting with people is after we're done talking, they're like, wow, I feel like a weight's been lifted off my shoulder because my spouse and I, we've been talking about this forever. And we were always kind of like, do we do this or do we do that? We spoke with someone that's not in the middle of what we're trying to do here, and we both really have a clear direction on what we need to do now. And yeah. That is often one of the big pieces. It's just like, you know what? Someone was able to just look this over and say, what about this?
It's and the, we kinda, the idea of having a wingman, right?
Yeah.
You've got an independent party that's arm's length enough. Just that separation for perspective can be really magic.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell people, if you put your nose on the book, it's really hard to read it. You're too close.
You know how I kind of look at it? It's like two people with their hand on the steering wheel, and then another person just points and says, go that way. And then everyone's like, oh, we can just kind of put it on cruise control.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. So if you need to reach us, 541-375-0898. Otherwise, Merry Christmas, everybody. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.